Season 2, Episode 6, Sports Out of Time, Randall, opening pitch. Have you ever personally been in trouble with the law?
Wow. No, I have never personally been in trouble with the law.
Really?
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, traffic stops don't count, correct? I mean,
no, traffic stops don't count.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, no. I've never had... I'm sure I've had the opportunity, but I've never been in trouble. How about you, Sam? How about you?
Oh, I've definitely gotten out of things that I probably should have gotten in more trouble for.
Yeah.
I've been in the back of a police car for dumb reasons.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yeah. When we were in middle school, me and two of my buddies were going around, and this will show you what kind of date, this will date me a little bit. We
sure.
were going around a neighborhood in South Utica, and we were wearing like Halloween masks,
okay.
And we were knocking on people's doors and performing the song Build Me Up Buttercup to people when they would come to the front door. And somebody called the cops on us because they thought we were troublemakers, and the cops came and put us in the car, and the cop goes and talks to the lady who called the cops on us, comes back to the car, and he goes, "All right, this lady realizes you're all morons, and she's not going to press any charges. You're lucky that you didn't get shot." And then just at the end, I think I'm off scot-free. She goes, "Which one of you is Familaro?" And I go, "That's me." And they go, "Oh, this lady knows your mom." And I go, "Shit." I was like, "No, damn it. I was so close." So I had to go home and tell my poor mother that I got arrested for some dumb shit. But yeah, it's easy to get arrested for dumb stuff. But that's not quite what we're talking about today.
No,
today we're talking about some real criminals and their one chance at survival. That's right. Episode 6, we're looking at the Death Row All-Stars. Tell I'm from the 90s, because when you brought this up to me, I was like, is this episode about 90s hip hop? I was like, wait a second, is this about Death Row, the label that pays me? I'm sort of confused here.
Trouble because ain't nothing but a G-bang, baby. Too low-def G, so we crazy. Death Row is the label that pays me. Unfadable, so please don't try to fake this. But back to the lecture at hand.
No, Randall, I loved this story. This was one of those things, we talk about it all the time. Sometimes we get a story that I wasn't uber familiar with, and then I just fall head over heels for it. This was one of them. I think I was vaguely aware of this story, but man, what a wild time in America. It's a great example of what America was like.
I didn't know a lot about the story either, Sam, until I really dug into the research. And it's such a compelling, interesting story with just, I mean, how many different characters are in this story? It's just
so many people.
No, it's a good one. So I had a lot of fun researching, and then of course, just digging in. So I'm glad that you enjoyed it as well.
I did enjoy it, but we have to talk about something that is a pressing issue with this story.
Okay.
Now I know that you folks out there love all of my, or despise one way or the other, you either like or don't like all my weird little ad libs that I put in there. I got to tell you, folks, it is not going to be particularly easy to find any clips from actual games, because we're really going back into like 1800s, 1898, I think.
That's when the prison, but the story is in 1911 and 1912. Still a long time ago.
Yeah, and long before we're going to have any video content.
Yeah.
And certainly long before we have number one movies, books, and songs in America. So I do have to admit that I had to get a little bit creative with this week's pop culture time machine. So to get ourselves in the right head frame, I guess, I don't even know if this is going to help us at all to get in the right headspace. But Wyoming State Prison, the prison that we're talking about today, where the Death Row All-Stars are based out of, remained open until 1981. So today, we're going back to September 3rd, 1981, the final day that Wyoming State Prison was open. Kind of. I really can't get a date for when this prison actively closed. Like, I know it's sometime in 1981. I picked September 3rd simply because it allowed us to talk about some things we haven't already discussed.
That seems fair. Now, I would say this is a cop-out, Sam, because, but I understand why, because you're not going to find too many clips or anything from the early 1900s.
No.
But that being said, the date that you chose, I am so excited for the pop culture time machine.
I certainly didn't look for the best possible date and then use that. That definitely didn't happen. All right, but let's get into it this week. If you were going to the movies on September 3rd, 1981, after you noticed one tiny headline on the back of the paper that said, oh, look at that, Wyoming State Prison closed, whatever, and then moved on with your life, you were going out to see the number one movie in America, directed by Steven Spielberg. It's Raiders of the Lost Ark.
For nearly 3,000 years, man has searched for the lost Ark of the Covenant.
The Bible speaks of the Ark leveling mountains and laying waste to entire regions.
Not something to be taken lightly. No one knows its secrets.
Jones, do you realize what the Ark is? It's a transmitter. It's a radio for speaking to God.
An army which carries the Ark before it is invincible.
I just watched this, actually, probably less than 2 weeks ago. It's on Pluto right now for all you people who followed me to the free Pluto stream. Man, this movie, there's a lot of movies from like the 80s and 90s that I think of as quote unquote like perfect movies.
Yeah.
This is close. Like this is a stunning movie from 1980.
Not only is it an amazing movie, this is one of my favorite movies of all time because, you know, it came out in 81. I saw this in the theater in 1981. You know, that because it was right up my alley. I mean, it was Han Solo essentially being, you know, now Indiana Jones. That's how I knew
him. Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know that we need to go on about Raiders of the Lost Ark. I know we're going to give them some facts, but it's a tremendous movie.
It's funny though, because even as I was watching it, I've seen it again a million times. It's one of those movies that was just always kind of on. It still never gets boring. This is so obvious, but it's just any part of the movie that I turn on, I'm going to hang and stay with for the whole movie. It's an absolute trap. So for folks who've never seen this movie, set in 1936, of course, the film stars Harrison Ford as globe-trotting archaeologist Indiana Jones, who is battling Nazi forces to recover the long-lost Ark of the Covenant, which is said to make an army invincible. Mm. Along with his former romantic interest, Marion Ravenwood, played by Karen Allen, Jones races to stop rival archaeologist Dr. Rene Belloc, played by Paul Freeman, from guiding the Nazis to the Ark and its power.
Yeah, the Ark of the Covenant, the chest the Hebrews used to carry around the Ten Commandments.
What do you mean, Commandments? You're talking about the Ten Commandments?
Yes, the actual Ten Commandments, the original stone tablets that Moses brought down out of Mount Horeb and smashed, if you believe in that sort of thing. Any of you guys ever go to Sunday school?
Well, look.
The Hebrews took the broken pieces and put them in the Ark. When they settled in Canaan, they put the Ark in a place called the Temple of Solomon.
In Jerusalem.
Where it stayed for many years. Until all of a sudden, whoosh, is gone.
Where?
I mean, people know so much about this movie that I'm going to have a hard time, like, surprising them with anything this, right? We all know that George Lucas conceived this movie alongside Spielberg, their longtime friends, and it was, again, meant to sort of modernize all of those serial movies of the earliest 20th century, your Flash Gordon-type things of the world. What's interesting about this movie, though, is when the movie was being shown to audiences in the lead-up, people were not super interested in it, especially compared to Superman 2, which had also come out earlier this year.
Which is also a great movie that I just watched this weekend.
It's another classic film from this era. Despite the initial bad polling, though, this movie became the highest grossing film of 1981, earning approximately $354 million. And it played in some theaters for over a year, which is really interesting. If you look at the box office numbers, it's from an era when this movie will stop being number one for a while and then kind of pop back up. Like, it just sort of pops up. Yeah, multiple times throughout the rest of the year because people just can't get enough of it. They keep going back over and over and over
again. Yeah. Yeah, when there was nothing else to see that was new, they're like, let's go see Raiders again.
I mean, even for me, when the first Jurassic Park came out and I was a kid,
yeah,
you could only see that in the theaters until it came out in VHS. So I definitely went to the theater multiple times to see it over the course of like 2 months. Indiana Jones, of course, is the first entry in what becomes the Indiana Jones franchise, which includes Temple of Doom, 84, Last Crusade, 89, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, 2008, and the very recent Dial of Destiny from 2023. Yep. I can do this in four words. Bad, good, bad, didn't see it. So there you go. There's my review of those movies. There's also, of course, television series about young Indiana Jones. There's video games. There's comic books, novels, theme park attractions. Our good friend Roger Ebert, who we say sort of has kind of a mixed track record when it comes to these things.
Yeah.
He's right on the ball here. He's in love with this movie. Roger Ebert calls it a breathless, incredible adventure inspired by and celebrating childhood stories told in comic books and movies. He concluded the film was successful in its singular goal of entertaining and creating an epic adventure in the same vein as Star Wars, the James Bond movies, or the aforementioned Superman movies. Randall, this is right in your wheelhouse. I know you love this movie. You've mentioned it. But I kind of didn't realize that the Superman movie was such a big deal.
Oh, are you kidding? No, Superman was huge.
I'm not denying that I thought it was popular because I was aware of it, but I didn't know that, I guess, those Christopher Reeves, especially those first two Superman movies, had such a cultural impact.
Yeah, no, those were hugely impactful because, of course, I was of that era and I saw them in the theater. And like I said, Superman 2 was on TV over the weekend and I tuned in. And while obviously the special effects are from, you know, late 70s, early 80s, it's still an amazing movie to watch. And it was such a flashpoint in my childhood, in my generation. Huge films. Christopher Reeve was the man. And he was yeah, awesome as Superman.
You are the one they call president?
I am.
I see you are practiced in worshipping things that fly. Good. Rise before Zod. Now, kneel before Zod.
Superman 2, I remember enjoying more because I was a little bit older, and the Superman 1 was kind of his, you know, origin story, and then Superman 2 with the three villains was really fun for me as a kid.
Yeah,
so
General Zod, my guy.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this before we move on from Indiana Jones, just because we could go on for hours of it. Is there a particular scene in the movie that you think of first when you think of Indiana Jones these days?
The opening scene where, you know, that his escape from the booby traps and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that probably sticks out the most. And the other scene that I really, really, I always remember is the scene in the bar with Marion and the Nazis come and he burns his hand. And yeah, that's the big fight. It's a great scene. I mean, but there's so many. How about you?
Well, I mean, obviously the things that come to my mind first are, of course, I forget who plays him, but the guy who plays Indy's buddy, who's talking to him when they look down into where the Ark is. And he's like, asps. Very dangerous. You go first. That guy. That's all I ever think of is that guy. But I will admit that this movie, 1981, you got to remember when this comes out, I'm not even born yet. So by the time I see this movie, you know, I see it as a kid. I would say that the last half of this movie not only scared me, but terrified me. I was absolutely horrified, especially the ending. Really scared the shit out of me as a kid. Yeah,
absolutely. It was. It was a terrifying ending.
But yeah, that's probably what sticks with me. And again, this movie, you know, Steven Spielberg, George Lucas, Harrison Ford, top men. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Top men.
For sure.
All right. As you leave the movie theater from seeing one of the greatest movies you'll ever see, you can get into your car and listen to the number one song in America, maybe one of the most successful love songs ever made. It's Endless Love by Lionel Richie and Diana Ross. This is like a song that I feel like I know more about, like the idea of it, than actually the song. Like, this is a song I feel like they joke about on Friends and stuff. Like, they have a whole bit on Friends about this. What's your recollection of the song "Endless Love," Randy?
Oh, I remember this, yeah, very well. You know, and I'm sure I've heard it since we listened to '80s on 8 on Sirius XM radio. I hear this from time to time. So, yeah, this is Lionel Richie. I think this was the beginning of his solo career, if you will, even though this is a duet, right?
This is his first single after leaving the Commodores. So this is really his big solo.
Okay.
I mean, Diana Ross is there, but for him, yeah, this is like his first chance to show that he's got the goods.
Yeah. And, I remember my sisters had Lionel Richie albums. So this, but not the Commodore. So this, his solo work was really what I knew Lionel Richie to be.
This feels like a song they would have played at like a school dance in the 80s.
Sure.
You and your girlfriend were getting real close for a little slow dance.
Roller skating party. For
roller
sure.
skating.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's when I would have left the roller skating floor because I didn't have anywhere.
Going to the arcade. Yeah, I got a little arcade.
Yeah, next I got nothing to do here. Yep.
Little Pac-Man. This song is obviously very popular, covered by Luther Vandross and Mariah Carey, also covered by Shania Twain. Kenny Rogers, who is Lionel Richie's longtime friend and occasional co-worker, has also done a recording of this song. Billboard named the original version as simply the greatest song duet of all time. I think that's a kind of bold. Are we just ignoring Islands in the Stream? We're just moving right past Islands in the Stream?
Apparently, yeah. That is a pretty bold statement.
Islands in the Stream, that is what we are.
Song was used as the theme for the Franco Zeffirelli film adaptation of the novel Endless Love.
Okay.
So Richie and the arranger Gene Page release a single for the film soundtrack in 1981. The movie itself is not that big of a success, but the song is a huge success. Again, second biggest selling single of the year. In the United States, reaches number one on the Hot 100. It stays there for 9 weeks. There's one song that sells more singles that year. And for folks who've heard it, it's Bette Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes.
Her hair is hollow gold. Her lips sweet surprise. Her hands are never cold. She's got Bette Davis Eyes. She'll turn her music. Have to think twice. She's pure as New York snow. She got Bette Davis eyes.
I can't believe that was sold more. I that
weird,
surprises
right?
me.
It
yeah.
surprised me.
It's a strange song.
Well, again, you'd think that Endless Love would be more successful. It is the most successful duet of the rock era. It surpasses the Everly Brothers' 1957 hit, Wake Up Little Susie, which had spent 4 weeks at number one. It becomes the biggest selling single of Diana Ross's career and
wow.
her 18th and final number one single in the U.S. And this includes her work with the Supremes.
Interesting.
I mean, this song, again, I'm not the biggest, like, sappy love song type guy, but I think it's hard to not hear this song and be like, oh yeah, I get why people were into this in 1980.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. For sure. Yeah.
it is not the first song I think of when I think of Lionel Richie. That, of course, would be Hello.
Oh, I was going to go Dancing on the Ceiling, but
Dancing with the Ceiling was the other one I was thinking. Oh, man. And finally, you can get home. And after seeing a classic movie and listening to a classic love song, you can sit down for one of the classic horror stories. It finally happened, folks. It's here. The number one book in America, Cujo by Stephen King. Oh, man. So it's funny. I have a friend who just started reading Stephen King books.
Okay.
And she asked me, you know, what's a good place to start? I'm like, well, there's a million books. I told her the places that I would start would be like Salem's Lot or Carrie or The Shining or early stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And when they asked me about Cujo, I said, no, don't start with Cujo. And we'll get there in a minute.
Okay.
So for folks who've never heard this story or seen the movie, Cujo is the story of a rabid St. Bernard and his terrifying interactions with the Trenton family in and around the town of Castle Rock, Maine. That's the most baseline synopsis I can give you. Stephen King discusses Cujo in his book On Writing, and this is probably the thing that most people remember about this book if you're Stephen King fans. He refers to it as a novel that he, quote, barely remembers writing at all. This novel came out during the height of King's struggles with alcohol addiction. He goes on to say that while he likes the book and wishes he could remember enjoying the good parts of it, he does not remember barely anything about the process of writing it.
Incredible.
So according to King, this novel is inspired by a trip to the mechanic. During the spring of 1977, he brings his motorcycle to an auto shop in the outskirts of Bridgeton, Maine. His motorcycle dies as he arrives at the shop, and moments later, a St. Bernard emerges from the garage, growling at him and lunging for his hand. The mechanic stops him, but King is still thinking about this.
Mm-hmm.
Not too much longer after that, an incident published in the Portland, Maine newspaper talks about a young boy who had been killed by a St. Bernard. So between these two stories, this is more than enough inspiration that King needs. Furthermore, King also owned a dysfunctional Ford Pinto, which is the car featured in the novel that's in the famous scene at the end. So again, much like many other Stephen King novels we'll talk about in the future, just pulling things from his life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Randall, have you ever read this book?
You know what, Sam? I have not read this book. And I've read most Stephen King books, but not this one. I've seen the movie.
So you've seen the movie. Excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah. Folks, I hate to do this for you, but the thing that you have to understand about Stephen King in this era, not all Stephen King books are like happy ending type books. He's a horror writer, right? This book, along with Pet Sematary, I would say end in the darkest fashions possible. Like, these are bleak novels, right? And if you've never read a Stephen King book before, that's why I don't recommend it. Because if you assume that all Stephen King novels are this bleak, you'll never want to read them anymore. One of the things about this novel that's so interesting is it's pretty short. It's a really concise, like 300 some odd pages. And he is not afraid to go to places that you don't think he's going to go to.
Really?
Now, Randall, you said that you have seen the 1983 film adaptation. Is that correct?
I did. You're correct. Yeah,
any recollections, any thoughts about that version of this story?
I just remember the dog being terrifying in the movie. And, you know, this will sound weird, Sam. I can read a horror novel all day long, but I'm not a big fan of horror movies.
That's right. Yeah.
And I don't know that I saw it in 1983, but I was definitely young when I saw it. So yeah, it scared me. I mean, you know, it can have an effect on you, especially when you're young.
Nothing that lives in the imagination is more frightening than the terror that lives in Castle Rock, Maine.
Cujo?
Yeah, so directed by Lewis Teague, starring Dee Wallace, Daniel Hugh Kelly, and a young Danny Pintaro. Film, of course, follows the mother and her son, particularly at the end of the movie where they're trapped inside the car while protecting themselves from a rabid St. Bernard. I like this movie just fine. It got mostly mixed reviews and did pretty well during its theatrical release. But okay. Today, it is sort of seen as a cult classic. And when you're listing Stephen King properties, it's usually closer to the top than it is toward the bottom in terms of adaptations. When talking about the movie, Janet Maslin of the New York Times wrote that the film was, quote, by no means a horror classic, but it is suspenseful and scary. Variety panned it as a dull, uneventful entry in the horror genre, a film virtually devoid of surprises or any original suspense. Gene Siskel, our good friend from the Chicago Tribune, gave this film 1 star out of 4, calling it one of the dumbest, flimsiest excuses for a movie I have ever seen. Roger Ebert called it dreadful. And Lisa Gross, the Los Angeles Times, wrote that no theater is air-conditioned enough to justify watching this scary, gory, and beastly film. Okay, so here's where the Stephen King fan in me struggles to come through here, right? One of the things I like about the novel is Stephen King's willingness to go to places at the end of the novel that you do not expect. Okay. Right? You look at the story where it's going and you go, okay, I think I have an idea what's going to happen here. And then you get to the end and go, Jesus, I do not. Oh my God, I can't believe it. Right?
Okay.
1983 film adaptation of the novel features a much more optimistic conclusion than you get in the original book, which is why when I watch it, while I like this movie, I do sort of feel like it's a bit of a cop-out.
Okay.
Right? Like, yeah. I want it to be that brutal ending. And this is not uncommon. We've talked about The Mist, I think, before by Stephen King, which the ending of that movie differs very much from the book version, and whether you like one or the other is really a preference thing, I think.
Sure, sure. Well, now I think I have to read this book.
It's a very short read. I think that if it's, I don't want to call it a breezy summer read because it's a dour, but you know, it's quick and you'll get through it pretty quickly if you're a good reader. And that, folks, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Endless Love, Cujo, the number one album, song, and book in America, 1981. What a time to be alive, huh?
Absolutely.
This might be the best three combined, I think, of the ones we've had so far this year.
Yeah, those are all awesome.
Yeah.
So without a doubt, I mean, I don't think there's anybody who wouldn't know, at least know of those three.
Right. I would hope so. Well, young folks, I suppose. Before we get into this week's episode, Randall, I think we all know what time it is.
It is Trivia Out of Time. That's what time it is.
Trivia out of time. Time. I love it. All right, Randall.
Trivia out of time. Time. Yeah, I like that.
I am 0-2 so far in our trivia game, which is about right because I'm only good at trivia when it has to do with like Seinfeld or Twin Peaks. But what do we have for me here? What's our trivia question?
Here is our trivia question for you, Sam, and for everyone else listening. This, since we're going to go way back to the early 1900s and we're talking about baseball, I'm going to ask this simple question. When did professional baseball begin in the United States?
When did professional baseball begin in the United States? Interesting. Yes. Interesting. That's a pretty good one. And we will find out the answer in our final segment. But now, folks, it is time to get into the meat and potatoes of this week's discussion, the Death Row All-Stars, Episode 6, Season 2. Let's do it.
You know, Sam, baseball has seen its share of bad boys. I don't mean like, you know, Carl Everett was a nut job.
And, he was a nut job.
Right. Roger Clemens could have been deemed a bad boy because he was, you know, controversially threw a bat at Mike Piazza. I'm not talking Albert Bell, who would like, Yeah, I think he who was that guy he bowled over in the second base? Was it Jose Lima or somebody like that?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh god, yeah, god, what a weird moment in time.
Right. Or AJ Pierzynski, who's kind of like one of those guys that nobody really liked unless he was on your team. Right.
One of the things I always hate are like unwritten rules of baseball guys. So like Brian McCann was one of those guys who used to drive me crazy. Just unlikable. Right. Yeah.
You're like, okay. And I'm not talking the steroid era either, like the Barry Bonds and the Mark McGuire's and the Sammy Sosa's. I'm talking really bad boys. Okay?
You're talking crime. You're talking criminals. Yeah. You're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So several players. Major league players have been convicted of sexual assault, including Mel Hall, Chad Curtis, Lenny Dykstra.
Mm-hmm.
Ugeth Urbina was convicted of attempted murder after he and some friends attacked a group of men they accused of stealing a handgun. The group attacked these men with machetes, poured gasoline on them, and attempted to light them on fire.
That's a very intense way of going with things. One, yeah, yeah.
Right? In 1991, relief pitcher Julio Machado shot and killed someone after a car accident in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typically, when these types of incidents with Major League Baseball players occur, it's after their retirement from the game, or if it happens during their playing days, their career's over, right?
Oh, yeah, big time.
Yeah, but today's story is about a group of players who became all-stars, so to speak, after they committed their crimes.
Shortly after Wyoming Territory was formed in 1868, a provision was established to construct a territorial prison in Laramie City. This first attempt of establishing a prison failed, and in 1888, a new prison was authorized to be built in Rawlins. Construction of the new facility began that same year, but wouldn't begin to receive inmates until December 1901.
Of all the things we've talked about this year, we talk a lot about how some of these things, how come there isn't a documentary? How come there isn't a movie? When I look at this story, I can't believe there hasn't been like an HBO or a Netflix series about this, because that's what I'm thinking about when I look at this story. I'm like, oh, yeah, you could do a whole couple seasons about this story.
Absolutely. So, Sam, the Death Row All-Stars were a group of convicts in the Wyoming State Penitentiary in 1911 and 1912. Now, the prison was located in Rawlins, Wyoming, which at the time would have been considered a frontier town. Now, the penitentiary all-stars were a fleeting sensation, a collection of random convicts that just happened to be great at America's favorite sport at the time. That the small town of Rawlins would allow such miscreants to enjoy the game's pleasures is surprising, as the frontier town had long shown a strict, old-world approach to conquering crime. Perpetrators caught in the act of robbery, rape, or murder in the town were not only hanged, but sometimes actually skinned. Various items were made from the hides of these unfortunate lawbreakers, sold as souvenirs, and used as a warning to other would-be felons. One such unlucky felon, George Parrott.
Randall, let me ask you a question. Do you like Western TV shows and Western movies, stuff like that?
They're not my favorite, but I don't mind them. They could, if they're done well, I like them.
I know my grandparents liked them. My both grandparents, they loved, you know, army movies and Wild West movies. And okay. I know that, you know, it's not a surprise that in this country we've really built up the mythos of the American Old West, the American frontier spirit, and the Western spirit.
Absolutely.
And what's really fascinating about that to me, because I teach global history and it's all like, you know, thousands and thousands of years, is what we tend to get really excited about and the Old West is really about 30 years of American history. It's like 1865-ish till almost 1895. That's essentially the period that we sort of clump everything in as the Wild West, right? Sure. And we've built lots of mythos over the years. So I just wanted to give you an idea. This is what period of time we're looking at here. This falls right into the American West, the expansion of the American people into the Western, Manifest Destiny, Deadwood, for all you Deadwood people out there. That's right in the same sort of vein.
When the Wyoming State Penitentiary was opened in 1901, it was one tough place. This was a time when the West was called wild, and the outlaws pervaded the land. Still, not long before the prison was opened, you could say that criminals faced a rougher kind of justice if apprehended.
And just for some context, in February of 1879, when Big Nose George Parrott and his cohorts are hanging out in Montana, Wyoming isn't even going to be a state for another 11 years. This is still just a territory, right? So this is the time we're talking about. Anyway, Big Nose George, George Parrott, and his cohorts are in what is today Miles City, Montana. Now, it's known around this time that there is a local merchant named Morris Kahn who will be taking money back east to buy stocks of merchandise. George, Charlie, and the two others carried out this very daring daylight-style robbery, classic Old West stuff here, right?
Yeah.
And it's not like Morris Kahn is traveling light. He's got 15 soldiers. He's got two officers, an ambulance, a wagon with a bankroll. He's tasked with carrying the army payroll. I'm not going to get into every detail here. This is a much deeper story. The gang dons masks and stations themselves at the turn of a trail. They surprise and capture the lead element of soldiers as well as the ambulance. Likewise, they capture the rear element of soldiers. Kahn is essentially robbed of between $3.6 and $14,000. I don't have the conversion for you off the top of my head,
right?
But it's a lot of money for 1879. Absolutely. And in classic fashion, Big Nose George and his crew get caught essentially because they're drunk and running their mouths about killing two lawmen as they get into Miles City, essentially identifying themselves as having a price on their head. They're captured and returned to Wyoming to face charges. But what happens is on April 2nd, 1881, while they're in Rawlings, Wyoming, in the jail cell there, Parrott tries to escape. He goes through a relatively daring escape attempt. He uses a file and a pocket knife and a piece of sandstone. He hits the jailer with his shackles. You know what I mean? It's a very dramatic event. But long story short, he doesn't escape, right? He does not escape.
Okay.
Right? But the news of this escape starts to make its way through Rawlins, and people are talking, and they're starting to make their way to the jail. So while the deputy, while the sheriff is recovering, masked men with pistols burst into the jail. They hold the sheriff at gunpoint, they take his guns, and they drag Big Nose George Parrott from his cell. The rescuers, it turns out, are not people to save him. These are people who are going to lynch George Parrott to death. That's right. They're angry at the... this is a good example of old school mob justice. There
right,
is no
absolutely.
There's no law here. It's the townsfolk have taken it upon themselves to do the justice here. Parrott and Charlie Burris, another member of his gang, are lynched. They are hung from a telegraph pole. And that's sort of where things get real dark. It's about to take a real dark turn here, folks.
Take, for instance, the story of the killer and robber Big Nose George Parrott. He was arrested in 1881 and was sent to the local jail in Rawlins. Big Nose, who certainly had quite the snout, must have thought his luck was in when he busted out of that jail. But it turned out that his rescuers were a local lynch mob. These town folk weren't willing to wait for the authorities to deal with him. Around 200 of them strung Parrott up from a telegraph pole.
Doctors Thomas McGee and John Eugene Osborne, remember that name, take possession of Parrott's dead body after this. Back then, we used to think that there are different parts of your brain that controlled different aspects of your behavior. And it's going to piss me off that I can't remember the exact term right now. But essentially, they would like look for parts of your brain, which you were a criminal or not. Right. So they took his brain and the top of Parrott's skull was sawn off and presented to Dr. McGee's 16-year-old medical assistant, Lillian Heath. So here you are. Here's a gift to you, 16-year-old child.
Oh, jeez.
The sawed off top of George Parrott's head. That she now, here's the interesting thing about Heath. She becomes the first female doctor in Wyoming and is said to have used the skull cap as a pen holder, a doorstop, and an ashtray. Do you think that's rough? It's gonna get worse. Parrott, a death mask is also created out of Parrott's face, the skin from his thighs and his chest, as well as his nipples. They are sent to a tannery in Denver, where they are made into a pair of shoes and a medical bag. They are kept by John Eugene Osborne, who wears the shoes at the inaugural ball after he is elected the first Democratic governor of the state of Wyoming.
Oh, my God.
He shows up with the skin shoes on for his inauguration.
The Wyoming State Penitentiary Museum in Rawlins has on display what is believed to be a death mask of Big Nose George, as well as a small leather pouch said to have been made from his skin. But regardless of its veracity, The legend of Big Nose George's skin shoes has become a lasting part of Wyoming folklore and continues to fascinate and rightfully horrify people to this day.
This story did actually not really come back to light until the 1950s, when there was further like DNA analysis that brought back the bag itself has never been found, the theoretical medical bag that was made. Now, why am I telling you this horrible, horrible and horrible story about violence in the Old West? Well, this left a pretty traumatic effect on the town, and this is actually part of the early reason for the creation of what we're going to be talking about in just a minute, the Wyoming State Penitentiary.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So as Mr. Familaro's History Corner just taught us, no setting could have been more perfect than Rawlins.
No place in the world.
Now, today, the town is an insignificant way station along Interstate 80, about 50 miles north of the Colorado border, straddling the U.S. continental divide. But at the turn of the last century, it was a rough and tumble railroad town featuring particularly savage variant of Western justice, which we just discussed.
I just want to make a point. This is not unique to Wyoming. Many of these towns at this time are also quite rough and tumble with this mob justice.
So the Wyoming State Penitentiary opened in 1901, and in keeping with the mood of the town, subjected its prisoners to harsh conditions, especially under the command of Otto Graham. Graham was a millionaire who established a broom factory in the prison. The state paid him to look after the prisoners. He paid for their, quote, well-being. And after they spent their days assembling his brooms, he sold them for hefty profits, earning almost $250,000 from 1903 to 1911, which is equivalent to approximately $8 million today.
Graham benefited immensely from the prison's broom factory, but his inmates did not. To maximize profit, used tomato cans were used as drinking cups, and inmate meals were calculated down to the last bean, which was just sufficient enough to prevent starvation. By 1911, guards had been murdered. Several prisoners who had attempted to escape had been killed, and one prisoner had been beaten and hung by other inmates. The situation at the prison had escalated to the point that it had become a growing concern for much of the state.
This is the start of what you'd see a lot of prisons do over the next decade, 20, 30, 40 years, before a lot of regulation comes in, using prisoners in ways that can make them money. I think the most famous example people see of this is go look at the movie Shawshank Redemption, which, again, the warden using the prisoners for dubious methods to make money on the side of simply being a prison facility.
He's got his fingers in a lot of pies from what I hear.
2 years and half of it. He's got scams you haven't even dreamed of. Kickbacks on his kickbacks. It's a river of dirty money running through this place.
Yeah, but the problem with having all that money is that sooner or later you're going to have to explain where it came from.
Well, that's where I come in. I channel it, filter it, funnel it. Stocks, securities, tax-free municipals. I send that money out into the real world, and when it comes back...
Clean as a virgin's honey pot, huh?
Cleaner.
Now, according to the prisoners, the conditions under Graham were merciless and of the dark ages, saying that meals were calculated down to the last bean so that just enough food was served to prevent starvation. When it opened for business in 1901, the new penitentiary had neither running water or electricity. Over the years, physical improvements were made, but never enough to dent the place's reputation as one of the toughest jails in the West. Among the famous outlaws who spent time at what was known locally as the Crossbar Hotel were Butch Cassidy and Frank James, the brother of Jesse James.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, in April of 1911, this system was banned by the state. So, a very unhappy Graham was out, as were his big broom profits, and Bighorn County Sheriff Felix Alston was named the new warden. Let's remember Felix Alston's name. By most accounts, Alston took a far more compassionate view of prisons, instituting reforms including exercise for the prisoners, a road building program that got them outside during the day, and an inmate baseball team.
Prisoners were allowed outside of the prison cells during recess sessions, and baseball was one of the few enjoyable activities they could do together. Alston, an avid baseball fan, quickly observed that many of the inmates were very good athletes and excellent ball players. Some, he observed, may have been just as good as the professionals. After seeing the morale boost baseball had provided the inmates and how well they played, he decided to go to his friend Governor Carey to ask for permission to organize a team.
So Warden Felix Alston put together a pretty decent baseball team. Decent, that is, in how they performed as players, not in how they were as people. They
I think when we talk about criminals here, we're not talking about, you know, like tax cheats. This is a real particular type of criminal. I'll let you do that.
Yeah. After all, they were in prison or even on death row. I mean, it featured some of the hardest of hardened criminals.
Yeah.
Three murderers, three rapists, five thieves, and a forger who would be the tamest of them all, right?
Yeah, he feels like the odd man out here, the guy who forges checks. Like, yeah.
Right. The team's pitcher, Thomas Cameron, was a convicted rapist. The team's captain, George Sabin, was a convicted murderer who had ambushed three sleeping sheep herders and shot each one in the face at close range. Incredibly, Sabin got away with a lenient 20-year sentence. It helped that he was best friends with the arresting officer that day, then Sheriff Felix Alston.
I want to let you keep going. I just want you all folks to know we're going to come back to George Sabin right at the end, because there's a reason I think that Sabin gets the more lenient sentence. There's a lot of question about what was going on with him, and that deserves a longer conversation. But I just want to bring that up. George Sabin, keep that mind in the back of your head for now.
The inmates were given brand new dark blue uniforms trimmed in white with WSP embroidered across the chest. The warden's son became the team's mascot. The All-Stars were led by Joseph Sane, a strong hitter who played outfield. He had been convicted of murdering his lover's husband. And team captain and second baseman George Sabin, who had murdered several shepherds during the Wyoming Sheep Wars.
So, led by their star player, convicted murderer of his lover's husband, Joseph Sane, the All-Stars were a pawn in an ongoing political power struggle by state officials. Now, they played just four games, winning all, but everyone was infused with more local drama than a modern World Series. Many in town, from local bar patrons to team captain George Sabin, himself a convicted murderer, to the prison warden himself, had substantial sums wagered on the All-Stars to win. The people of Rawlins were not only baseball mad, but also gambling mad.
Yeah.
And that was one thing they had in common with the All-Stars, as well as with Warden Felix Alston. Indeed, during the death row All-Stars run, team captain George Sabin developed a sideline as a bookie, going to local saloons and dives, taking bets on his team's games and pocketing a 20% commission.
Mm-hmm.
Again, he's the convicted murderer, but he can come and go and be a bookie.
This is a, you know, again, it's funny, even here, it's good to have connections. Even in 1911,
absolutely,
it's good to know some people. It's good to have a little extra cash floating around. That never went out of style, even today.
Yep. It's not what you know, it's who you know, Sam.
Absolutely.
Eager to put his team on display, Alston challenged local teams to compete against his All-Stars. Once word got around about the matchup, it quickly became one of the most sought-after events in the state. People from all around the territory came to watch the incredible scene of convicted criminals playing an organized game of baseball. No team has ever taken the field the way the All-Stars did. The 12 inmate team marched onto the field, chained together. They stood in front of the dugout as their shackles were removed under the watchful eyes of armed guards.
So the stakes for the convicts were higher than simply the thrill of victory or the agony of defeat. Wins, they were told, meant time off of their sentences.
Yeah.
Losses, however, came with consequences. Individual errors that cost the team the win, they were told, would result in death.
In death.
In his capacity as bookie, Sabin also made sure this information was communicated to the town's gamblers so they would know that the players were playing for their lives. Winning was one way to prolong a death row inmate's time. So the Wyoming State Penitentiary All-Stars played their first game on July 18th, 1911, with a 12-man roster that included three rapists, a forger, five thieves, three killers.
Dear God.
And at a time when only white players were allowed to play in the majors and minor leagues, two of the All-Stars, catcher James Powell and first baseman Eugene Rowan, were black. Jackie Robinson wouldn't debut for the Brooklyn Dodgers until 1947. playing the Wyoming Supply Company Juniors, which was one of the best teams in the area at the time.
Yeah.
And the All-Stars opponent for all four of their games, the All-Stars trounced them 11-1, largely thanks to right fielder Seng, who hit two home runs, including a grand slam.
Yeah.
Interest in the game was so intense that it was covered by newspapers across the country, including the Washington Post, which titled their article, "Slayer Scores Home Runs." The professional manner in which the players conducted themselves drew as much attention as their ability at the game. The Carbon County Journal, which referred to the team as the Cons, printed this about their obvious star. Joseph Seng, who was convicted of murder in the first degree and sentenced to death, played a classy game all the way through. He will petition the governor to commute his sentence to life imprisonment sometime this month.
Austin's All-Stars, as they were proudly nicknamed, were sensational and beat the Juniors 11-1, largely thanks to right fielder Seng, who hit two home runs, including a grand slam. The buzz from their game spread like wildfire and attracted even larger crowds of onlookers, anxious to not only watch a baseball game, but to catch a glance at the criminals suiting up to play. Those who attended the games reported that it didn't matter what the score was. The atmosphere and excitement generated by the All-Stars was just as if they were watching the World Series.
The turmoil, like you're talking about really the pressure to perform, try to perform with an armed guard aimed at you. Because again, you're a hardened criminal. Any move you make, anything silly or off-putting, they would have not thought for a second to just put you down. Play ball.
Absolutely. So local interest in the All-Stars' solid play might have spoken to something deep and primal in baseball that touched spectators' hearts, but it also fed another local interest, gambling.
People love to
gamble. Now, one person displeased with all of this was former warden Graham.
Mm-hmm.
Hoping to reinstate his broom business, because of course he's just got to make more money, he heard from a guard who was his informer in the prison that Saban was placing illegal bets on the games with Alston's money. Alston is the warden. Graham shared this information with his friend, Wyoming Senator Francis Warren, who was planning to run for governor against the incumbent, Joseph Carey, the man who appointed Alston. So Warren believed, or chose to believe, that Carey was involved in the gambling as well, and saw this as information he might be able to use.
Yeah, general consensus, even at the time, was that Carey was a pretty well-known gambler. So Warren's kind of taking a shot in the dark. Like, he's like, I know there's gambling happening. I don't necessarily have proof, but if there's gambling happening and Joe Carey's around, there's a good chance he's gambling.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
To secure his bet, Saban threatened his players that if they lost, time would be added to their sentence. But if they won, they would receive reduced sentences and stays of execution. He firmly stated that these orders came straight from Austin and would be followed without fail. These threats took hold, and the All-Stars played like their lives depended on it, for it did. They would go on to beat the Juniors three more times, scoring more than 11 runs in each outing.
So Joseph Seng's execution was set for August 22nd, 1911. On August 4th, they won their second game against the Juniors, also 11-1. Seng went 4-for-4 with a flawless day in the field as he awaited word on his appeal. He then went just 2-for-5 9 days later for the team's third game, but the Cons continued their bizarre streak of scoring 11 runs in a shot, this time winning 11-4. By summer's end, the inmates came to believe that Seng had lost his appeals and was being kept alive solely due to his talent for the sport. Scheduled to be hanged on August 22nd, he was still alive on the 23rd, perhaps because the team's next game was scheduled for the 29th. So their fourth victory by a score of 15-10 was also their last. In the days that followed, Alston began to speak of replacing baseball with education for the prisoners. In September, Governor Carey instituted a statewide crackdown on gambling, perhaps to deflect growing rumors spurred on by Graham that state officials had played some role in the gambling on the games.
Yeah.
And he wrote to Alston about his concerns for the team. So immediately afterward, Alston announced that the team's time had come and gone. Save and assured local gamblers, this would merely be a temporary hold meant to deflect attention until the gambling whispers died down. But by November of that year, the prison was being praised for its new education initiative, and the Death Row All-Stars faded into memory.
Governor Carey, fearing backlash from the community about the illegal gambling activities and to downplay any notion that he was involved in betting on the games, created a new anti-gambling campaign to cover his tracks. Austin, also concerned about the swirling accusations that the state was involved in betting on the games, discontinued the baseball team and instead shifted the prison's focus towards education. The All-Stars were no more.
So as for Seng, the stay, it turned out, had been arranged by his attorneys, but it was short-lived, and he was executed on May 24th, 1912. The Carbon County Journal, which less than a year prior had noted his classy style of play, paid him a different compliment this time, writing that as he approached the hangman's noose, his steps were steady, and he went to his death in a manner which stamped him as a brave man. Still pretty nice way to say that you just hung because you're a murderer.
It seems like from all the reporting that I looked at on this, everything, there was like some pretty positive public reception for him to get off. People felt as though, hey, it's not like this guy, his murder and his issue didn't seem like it was something that was as intense as some of the other people's. And I think there was some public turn on him that thought that maybe he was going to be able to get off from this. I think people were a little surprised that he didn't.
Yeah. I think you're right. So the players on the Death Row baseball team were Joseph Seng, the star pitcher and first baseman. He was convicted of killing his lover's husband in 1909. He was also the team captain and the leader of a prison escape attempt in 1911.
Come on, who didn't try that?
I think they did. Everyone tried that.
Everyone tried that.
Don't you think?
Yeah, you had to. Yeah.
Yeah. He was hanged, as we mentioned, in 1912. Thomas Cameron, the backup pitcher and second baseman, he was convicted of raping a 14-year-old girl in 1910. He was also involved in the prison escape attempt with Seng. He was hanged in 1913.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
George Sabin, the catcher and third baseman, he was convicted of killing a rancher in a dispute over cattle in 1909. And he was also the team manager and the liaison between the players and the warden. But he was pardoned in 1913.
That's right. Okay, so just do a quick secondary history corner here. So we need to talk about a period of time between 1870 and around 1920. It's kind of a broad period. There's a series of armed conflicts that happened in the Western United States between sheepmen and cattlemen over grazing rights to sheep and cattle. These are known as either the Sheep Wars or the Sheep and Cattle Wars. Yeah, these are the wars they don't teach you about in school because we don't really have time. This doesn't go on the curriculum necessarily.
Right.
But yeah, a real thing that happened. The generality here is the cattlemen see the sheep herders as invaders who are destroying public grazing land. I don't know how much people know about sheep and cattle, but it is known that sheep do a lot more damage to grass than cattle do on a per animal basis. Right.
Wars, also known as the Sheep and Cattle War, was a series of armed conflicts fought throughout the Western United States during the late 1800s. The two parties involved in the conflict were the sheep herders and cattle ranchers fighting over grazing rights. While not an officially recognized war, the conflict lasted over 50 years from about 1870 to 1920, including 120 engagements over 8 different states, and claimed the lives of over 100,000 sheep and 54 men.
They don't like that they have to share this land with them, so between 1870, between 1920, you got about 120 different small engagements that occur in around 8 different states and territories. You got 54 people who are killed, and about 50 to 100,000 sheep that are slaughtered, right? Some of the most violent fighting takes place, again, as our story goes, in Wyoming and Colorado regions of this.
The war began when the cattle ranchers felt their livelihood was being threatened by the invasion of flocks of sheep into public grazing lands. The sheep had a tendency to overgraze the land, causing it to be unusable for months. There was also a fear of sheep scab, a form of mange that infected the sheep, which could also pollute the water sources that were used for cattle. This destruction of the prized grazing lands angered many cattle ranchers, and soon conflicts arose.
Now, a real specific thing that happened, one of the more, the last serious conflict of the sheep wars, is something called the Sheep Creek Raid, also the 10 Sleep Murders. This is the murder that George Sabin is convicted of, okay. And that's what he goes to jail in the first place for. He's in a group with five other guys at the time. It remains uncertain, to be honest, whether or not his party or the other party shot first, although evidence suggests that it was George Sabin's side who shot first, right? but this is the event that sort of spurs Sabin's arrest and his addition to the team. I don't want to spend an hour here on the Spring Creek raids. It's a really cool story, and so is the Sheep Wars, but this is like that. Now we're getting way off topic here. But I just want to bring it up because the George Sabin thing is interesting because he is, again, seen from a lot of people's perspective as that was less of a violent crime and more of two separate acts of war. Like people were in war with one another, right? So it becomes a hard gray question of whether or not there was justification on one side or the other.
The conviction of the 10 Sleep Murders eventually brought the Sheep Wars to an end. Cattlemen were now reluctant to raid sheep camps for they were at risk of being punished by the law, which for many years was on their side. After over 100,000 sheep and 54 men lost their lives fighting over grazing rights, this legendary war of the West finally came to a close with the help of the federal government when they enacted the Taylor Grazing Act of 1934 to help regulate the use of public land.
And that's why he was pardoned in 1913.
Yeah. Also his connections and money, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, also exactly. That, yeah.
Yeah.
That too.
So getting back to the roster, they had William Boyer. He was the left fielder. He was convicted of killing a man during a robbery in 1908. He was also a skilled musician who played the violin for the prison orchestra, but he was hanged in 1913. Darius Rowan, the center fielder, he was convicted of killing two men and raping and killing six women in 1907. He was also a notorious cannibal who ate parts of his victims.
Oh,
he was hanged.
Ooh, yeah. Tough.
He was hanged in 1912.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans. And a nice Chianti.
Laszlo Korda, the right fielder. He was convicted of killing a man during a card game in 1909. He was also a talented artist who painted portraits of his fellow inmates. He was hanged in 1913. Frank Palmer, the shortstop, he was convicted of forging checks in 1910. Mm-hmm. So he was he's the forger, the one with no murder in his background. I know. At least there's somebody. He was also a master locksmith who helped Seng and Cameron with their escape plan. Of course, who didn't?
Yeah, everyone was involved.
Yeah. He was pardoned in 1914. And then James Moore, the utility player, he was convicted of stealing horses in 1910. Again, not a violent criminal.
Mm-hmm.
He was also a former professional baseball player who played for several minor league teams. He was pardoned in 1915. Now, I tried to look up James Moore to see where he may have played, but I only found a James Moore from 1906 that played in the New England. New England minor leagues, but
sure.
There was nothing else about him. So,
Baseball Reference doesn't go back far enough for this, is what you're saying.
It did not catch that. James Moore. So not until 1920 did baseball return to the Wyoming State Penitentiary, and several more years passed before the prison team was allowed to play outside opponents. In 1981, the old penitentiary closed its doors forever. These days, it is a tourist attraction renamed the Wyoming Frontier Prison, and visitors may spend a night in a cell and even have themselves locked into the shiny restored gas chamber in which five Wyoming State Penitentiary All-Stars met their end.
That is wildly morbid. I was interested in going until that part. That feels really depressing at the end.
Well, I don't know that you have to do that, but you can.
If you're there and you're staying there, I guess you're supposed to, right?
I guess you have to do this. That's the story of the Death Row All-Stars, which I think you're right. This would have made a great HBO series.
I was thinking about this just now. So the escape, the failed escape with Palmer, Seng, and Cameron, that's your pilot episode, right? That's the start of the episode. You introduce those guys in the failed escape. Yeah, and you pull them all back in. Do like a Quentin Tarantino lineup. Maybe you do a bottle episode about the Sheep Wars.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it would go over well, especially with like the popularity of Yellowstone and all those shows this is right up that alley.
Oh yeah. And I think and you have that sports and Western connection. I think there's a good angle here. Don't steal this from us, somebody. Someone's gonna steal this from us now.
Somebody who can actually make that happen, don't steal it from us.
Yeah,
we
it's hard.
Make that happen.
No, but if you're gonna make it happen, bring us in on bring making in it happen. Yeah, bring yeah, us bring in us on in. Making it happen. That's all
Dude,
we
appreciate
ask.
It.
Just a little wet the beak. That's all I'm looking for. Because again, I'm like George Saban here. I just want to be involved, right?
Exactly.
Little booking, taking a little numbers, little liaison. That's all I'm looking for.
That's
here.
It. That's all I need.
Yeah, I love this period of history too, because again, I think when we think of the idea of cowboys and Indians and that like sort of idea of like, you know, Shane, like the movie Shane, like walking onto a ranch, that's a very beautified version of what the Wild West actually was. Even a show like Deadwood is a little Hollywooded up from the sort of dirt and grime of what it would have been like. It was rough living.
Oh yeah. Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, you know, it was rough, and you know, as you continue to go back in history, it just gets more difficult, right? And you're right. We glorify all parts of history, and when you know, typically for entertainment purposes, right? That's what we do. But yeah, it's I wouldn't have survived in the frontier. There's no doubt.
For sure. But here's the thing, right? Here's I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's easy to romanticize the notion of looking back at a theoretically simpler time, right? Because you can easily talk yourself into the idea of like, oh, it would be sweet to own like a ranch and have tons of land that I could just fish on and chill and hunt and do my stuff with my family all day. But also, you know, the Death Row All-Stars could come rob your stuff and burn your farm down in any second, right? So there's a certain level of like, okay, there's something we teach in history. There's a real basic philosophy concept. And if you've heard of this before, Randall, I'm sorry, but for people out there, it's called the social contract. Social contract is the most basic principle of philosophy. Sure. It's essentially the idea that we as a species were born free in a world without government, in a world called the state of nature. We as human beings are born free. But most human beings will engage in what's called the social contract, which is you're willing to give up some of your freedom in order to live in a society.
And this term social contract is first formally used by Rousseau, another Enlightenment author, about 100 years later, talking about this willingness to give up some rights in order to protect the ones that you really, really, really want to have. And you would be giving up those rights to some form of a government. That is the social contract between the people that are governed and the government that governs them.
How much of your personal freedom you're willing to give up sort of is defined by what kind of person you are, whether, you know, politically or philosophically. But that's sort of the idea here. The Old West was sort of America's acceptance of the social contract. How much civilization are we willing to accept to live in a society? We'll all agree that we can't just kill each other and have mob justice and string people up in exchange for roads and the mail and the, you know, and a telegraph system. Right. So that's sort of one of my favorite parts about this period of time is the America's acceptance of the social contract from sea to shining sea. Yeah, that's the Old West, guys. Yeah.
Well said, Sam.
It's funny. I don't even teach American history. This is all outside of my. Randall, this was a lot of fun. I appreciate you bringing this story up. And again, I'm just always blown away when we start these seasons. I always think to myself, God, it's going to be so hard to find new stories. What are we going to do? And somehow, as we get into it, we just keep finding more stories that I can't believe we missed. And this was great.
Right. Good. Glad you liked it.
I did. Let's get back out of the Old West and let's get back into modern times, and we'll look at some more topical stuff before we close up for this week. All right, man. That was excellent. Great stuff. I just love, again, yeah. That's the history teacher in me. I just love how different things seem in the world now compared to, even again, like 1920, 1910s, 1900s. It might as well be a different planet.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You're like this. It doesn't even seem like, we're different people. Everything is different. But it's so much fun to go and look at that. Obviously this is a sports history podcast, so you and I must enjoy the history of things. And if you're listening, I hope you do too. It's so much fun to go and look at that stuff.
Oh yeah. All right, Randall. I can't wait any longer. Just for folks, so they remember, what was our question again for trivia out of time?
Yes, trivia out of time. When did professional baseball begin in the United States?
Okay. I'm going to give you an answer that I think is probably wrong because I think it's most... I'm going to say 1903. But there's a reason for that. So is that correct or incorrect?
Well, that is an excellent, excellent guess, but technically incorrect.
I had a feeling. Okay. Okay, yeah, so explain to the people.
So let me explain. Now, 1903 will come up in my explanation. Mm-hmm. So, and I would have given you credit for a couple of different dates, and here's why.
Sure.
So the Cincinnati Red Stockings, now the Cincinnati Reds, were the first professional baseball team, and they formed in 1869, right? But since there weren't any other professional teams, they were forced to play amateur clubs. All right. So the first fully professional sports league was the National Association of Professional Baseball Players, simply known as the National Association, and it was founded in 1871. Now, the first major league game was a National Association contest between the Cleveland Forest Cities and Fort Wayne Kekangas.
Fort Wayne Kekangas.
Kekangas. So if you can pronounce it better, go for it.
Spell it for me one more time.
Kekangas.
Kekangas. Wow. I got nothing. I think that's Kekangas. Right. I think that's about as close as you're going to get. Yeah.
Okay. Now, so that was in 1871. In 1876, the National League of Professional Baseball Clubs, known as the National League, which is the National League today, was established after the National Association proved ineffective. Mm-hmm. Now, the league placed its emphasis on clubs rather than players, which is what the Professional Baseball Players Association was doing.
Sure.
And the first National League game took place on April 22nd, 1876, when the Boston Red Caps beat the Philadelphia Athletics 6-5 in Philadelphia. And then there was a rival American Association, which would become the American League, and they formed in 1882. Mm-hmm. So for several years, the National League and the American Association champions met in a postseason championship series, the first attempt at a World Series. Mm-hmm. The two leagues merged in 1892. In 1903, Sam, that you mentioned, we saw the first official World Series between the AL champion Boston Americans, and they defeated the NL champion Pittsburgh Pirates 5-3 in a best of 9 series. So 1869 was the first professional team, but really the first game and league was 1871. And, so I would have given you credit for any of those dates. So I'm going to give you credit for 1903 because that was the first World Series. Good for you, Sam.
I'll take it because I'm 0 for 3 otherwise. So I'm going to take minor credit for this. Just a quick update. I did a little research on it, Kekanga. So Kekanga was actually the capital city known as Pecos Village of the Miami tribe. Again, we're talking, Native American.
Got it. Algonquin, okay, that makes Indians. Sense. Yeah.
Kekangwa actually means blackberry bush. So there you are. The Fort Wayne blackberry bushes.
Yeah, like, it would have been easier if they just called themselves that.
Yeah, the bushes. Yeah, they could be the bushes. That's great. So before we close up, Randall, I have a couple things we should discuss.
Yeah.
As it is the lead up to Thanksgiving. Well, of course, by the time people hear this, Thanksgiving will have already happened. But as we're recording it, Thanksgiving is on the way. We're a couple of days away.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to just quickly talk to you about the NFL on Thanksgiving. I feel like that is such a huge connection. Do you feel like I feel like I've barely watched any football this year, and somehow I'm kind of excited to watch the NFL on Thursday for Thanksgiving. What is it about this NFL Thanksgiving? Is it just tradition? Are we just, have we just been trained over the years to assume that these two things go together?
Monica and I aren't supposed to play football.
Says who, your mom?
Yes.
Well, every Thanksgiving, we used to have a touch football game called the Geller Bowl.
No, you say that proudly.
Anyway, Ross and I were always captains, and it got kind of competitive, and one year, Geller Bowl 6, I accidentally broke Ross's nose.
I think so. It's tradition. I think, you know, when growing up, it's like you wake up and you know you're going to have an afternoon football game on a Thursday, right?
Yeah.
Now we have games on Thursdays every night, so it's, you know, but you know, whether you watch them or not on Amazon is one thing, but now, you know, because it used to be one game, right? There used to be one game on Thanksgiving, which was, you know, everyone watched the game and then eat turkey, right? But now there's several games on Thanksgiving, which doesn't make it worse necessarily, because then you can watch football all day long. But I just think it was back in the day, it was such a tradition. And it was just knowing that you're waking up on Thanksgiving Day, you watch the parade, there's a football game, and then you eat turkey.
Here's where I'm going to be an old man. When I was younger and we were forced to watch football on Thanksgiving, it was because there was like one TV in the house. So you would all be sort of stuck in that room with your uncles and your dad and your your grandparents. And I actually sort of liked it as a kid, not because of the football, but because I liked being around all the men, like all the old men in my family and my cousins. Now I don't think that happens as much. Like when I put on a football game, it's usually, I mean, me and cousin Joe, shout out to cousin Joe. And, you know, there's a lot of people who are not interested in football. It doesn't feel the same as when we were kids, at least for me. Also because Barry Sanders isn't there.
They shouldn't probably give it up now. They should get Barry involved in this 2-minute drill.
Tommy Boyd in the game now as a third wide receiver. From the Chicago 40, there's Barry up the middle, 35, cuts to the right, 30, cuts it back over the middle, 20, to the 15, to the 10, to the 5, touchdown! Jim Brandstetter, you're a genius! 40 yards, the pay dirt, Barry Sanders! You must have been in the huddle! Holy mackerel!
And I guess before we leave, we only have about 2 minutes, but I have a question that I need your help on. Mm-hmm. You may notice that I am wearing a Lakers hoodie.
Oh yeah, I do see that.
And I've had this argument with people before, and they were like, "But you're not a Lakers fan." And I was like, "I know that, but I like sports gear."
Sure.
Where are you with wearing gear for teams that you don't support?
I'm okay with it. I would wear gear, whether it's a cap, a shirt. I have several like t-shirts. Our classic player shirts. I have like a George Brett Royals t-shirt. I have a Nolan Ryan Angels t-shirt.
Yeah, like the jersey.
So I don't have any problem with it. And the only exception I have is you cannot wear your rivals.
Right. So if I, as a Knicks fan, if I were wearing like some Miami Heat gear, that would be blasphemous.
Yeah, probably. If you, as a Yankee fan, you're not going to wear a Red Sox cap.
No, I think the Lakers and Knicks are far enough disconnected. Also, they got the Pat Riley connection, so that's okay. I'm like, we both Pat Riley. It's all right. Pat Riley was there. He brings us together in a way that otherwise wasn't. Hey, speaking of which, did you watch this Lakers show that was on HBO, this Winning Time, since we're talking about the Lakers?
I did. Yeah, I absolutely did.
Did you like it?
I loved it. I thought it was fun. Did you see it at all?
Well, I started watching it and I was like, why did people hate the show so much? It's kind of funny. I don't know what the negativity is.
I loved it. I thought it was amazing. I the way they filmed it was very interesting. Yeah. How they made it look all vintage and old. No, I enjoyed it, and I was disappointed that I think they're done after the second season, right? They're not bringing it back.
They're not.
I think they even stopped like midway, didn't they?
They essentially rushed the ending of season two because they weren't going to get a third season.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, I'm a big mark for Adrian Brody, and I just think Adrian Brody was born to play Pat Riley. It's like they're basically the same person. I loved every second of it.
You bitch again about Kareem. You're done. You hear me? That goes for all of you.
Well said.
Cap, where you been? Everybody's asking when you're going to retire. They're all trying to guess. I'll tell you when. It was 2 months ago.
Damn.
Shut up. Don't you show me those fucking teeth. You think I'm afraid of you?
Huh? But no, Ryan, no. I ain't even like that.
There's no press here. Come on, let's tell like it is.
All right, Randall, next week, an interesting episode, sort of a alternate episode that I snuck in on you last minute, so this should be very exciting. Mm-hmm. Season 2, Episode 7, we're going to take a look at the very topical story of Carrie Von Erich. But until then, have a great weekend, folks. We'll see you soon.